hour was come. There was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? In a time in which watches and clocks were not used, the Jewish day began at sunrise, which was roughly 6 o'clock in the morning. And the day, time of the day when the sun was at the pinnacle, that was considered to be the noon hour. It was considered to be the sixth hour of the day. They didn't know exactly if it was 12 o'clock straight up, but it was the middle of the day. And so when you read, it says that it was about the ninth hour. You read that over in the Gospel of Matthew. It means that it was in the part of the day when the sun was at its brightest. Something eerie began to happen. It began to darken. I don't think that it took a long time. I think that it was probably within just a minute or so. And it was no longer bright daylight. Midnight had come to midday. And so you have during this 3 hours, from around noon to about 3 o'clock, you've got silence as far as Jesus on the cross. Now, when he was nailed to the cross around 9 in the morning, he began to utter some things. He said, like our first utterance was this, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And when he said that, the thief on the cross knew that there would be forgiveness for people. And so he said, can I have that? And Jesus looked at him and said, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. And then in the midst of his suffering, he uttered a third thing, which I preached on last Sunday, when he said, woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother. And he gave the charge of his mother to John, his disciple, also his cousin, instead of his own brothers, because they were not believers. And so the first 3 hours, we see him suffering, a physical suffering. It's hard to breathe as he's nailed there. He has to push himself up on the little perch that they have nailed his feet on top of. But now something different begins to happen. It's now as though the curtain has been pulled on the sun, and it's dark in the middle of the day. And during this 3 hour span, I don't know if there's anybody that can truly tell you everything that took place. I know I can't. I know a few things that have taken place that I've been able to glean from the scriptures. But I don't know even the most mature Christian that you have ever heard, the greatest preacher that you have ever heard, I don't know if they can fathom the depths of what took place during that 3 hours of darkness. It's as though you're looking over the side of a boat, and you can see down, but you can't see the bottom. And that seems to be the way that this story is, at least from my perspective. And the reason that I want to preach on this today is not just because it's one of the cross sayings, but I want to try to somehow to describe to you what Jesus suffered for us. And because of the suffering that he suffered for us, what we ought to be obligated in our own hearts to want to do for him. And so I want us to think about three questions this morning. The first thing that I want you to think about is this: why did Jesus suffer? I mean, why did he, or not why, but what did Jesus suffer? Well, we know that he suffered physical torture. As he's hanging on the cross, there's a crown of thorns that are still jammed into his head. We know that he suffered humiliation publicly because they had basically stripped him naked, and he's hanging there with no clothes, and so he's humiliated. We know that he has been mocked because they have gone by wagging their tongues and wagging their heads at him, saying things like, if he's the Christ, let him come down off the cross and save himself, and then we'll believe. And so we know that there has been a mocking. We know that there are some people that really didn't care if he lived or died. We saw the Roman soldiers. And these Roman soldiers, they had five garments that they were basically trying to divide among themselves. There were four men that were doing the crucifixion. And each one took one of the four main garments, but because of the tunic that he had, that his mother probably had even made for him, because that was something that Jewish women did for their boys, they made them woven tunics that had no seams in them. And so instead of cutting the tunic up, they said, let's just gamble for it, and whoever gets it, I mean, he's about to die. Who cares? He's just like one of these thieves. We'll just take this and we'll at least get something out of this crucifixion. And so they didn't really care much about him. And so he suffered all of this indignity, all of this cruelty, all of this depravity, all of this hatred. He has suffered all of that. But now something's changing. The suffering that he is about to go through is a loss of fellowship with his heavenly Father. Can I tell you that there has never been a time in his life when the fellowship had been severed, but it is now. You've got the incarnation when he was born. And he left heaven's glory and took upon himself flesh, according to John chapter 1. And he had to grow up as a baby. And as a matter of fact, Luke chapter 2 tells us that he increased in wisdom with both God and man, wisdom and stature. And so there was always a fellowship, though, even as a boy, with the Father. It was not as full maybe as it was when he was seated by the right hand of the Father in eternity past. But even at the incarnation, God was there and the fellowship was there. Even when he was 12 years old, he said, I must be about my Father's business. And of course, during his earthly ministry, which was approximately 3 years, a little over 3 years, you have him and the Father, and they are always communing with each other. And so now, though, there's a separation. And you look at this separation, and as he hangs there in the darkness, one of the things that we see is that there was no friends that were present, except just a few ladies, and the scriptures tell us that now they were even at a distance. John was there, but perhaps he and Mary had already left. Maybe they were being rushed away by the Romans or forced to leave by the Orthodox Jews because sundown was coming. Wouldn't be but just a few hours and the sun would be down, but now there's darkness. And the only thing maybe you can hear is some murmuring in the darkness. Jesus is uttering nothing. There's no friends that are saying, Master, we're here. And you don't hear the Father from heaven saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, as you did at his baptism. Jesus is hanging there all alone. He is forsaken. The fellowship is over. And I don't know about you, but I've never really experienced what I consider to be being forsaken by people. I've never had a mother say, "I've got other things to do." I've never had a father that when I was a little boy that just walked off. I've never had that. I may have had some friends that kind of bailed every once in a while, and maybe I've experienced a little bit of that, but perhaps you've had somebody that has forsaken you. There's probably some men that are sitting here, and maybe you had a wife, and she just walked off one day. Maybe there's a wife or a lady that's sitting here, and maybe you had a husband, and next thing you know, he's leaving you with a house full of kids because he is tired of the grind, and you've been forsaken. But can I tell you that none of us have ever had God forsake us? As a matter of fact, the scriptures tell us on numerous occasions that he will be with us. But that's not what took place with Jesus. Jesus is now separated from the Father. Can you think of a word in the English language that is more disheartening than the word forsaken? I sat in my office early this week, and I just sat there for a little while, and I began to think, is there a word that is worse than that? And I don't know if there is one. When I think of forsaken, I think about a story that my own dad told me. My stepdad, was a policeman in Savannah for, I guess, probably well over 30 years. I remember almost on a daily basis, he would have his starched shirts and he'd have all of those things that would put all over his shirt, and he had a special pair of boots that he would wear when he was riding the motorcycle. It always bugged me whenever I was a kid growing up during the hippie age when they talked about policemen being pigs, because I knew how good of a man my dad was, and that bothered me. And so when he retired, he told me, son, I'm going to go fishing every day. And so one day, about 6 months after he retired, I went down to visit, and I said, "Hey, let's go fishing." He said, "I don't want to." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "I'm sick of it." He said, "I went every day for about 6 months." I said, "Well, Dad, what are you doing?" He said, "I got a job." And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I had a job as a dispatcher," and he called the name of the city. But he said, "I didn't really like that." He said, "So I got another job over at a boys' detention center." And in Claxton, Georgia, off the main thoroughfare that goes through there, over to the side, probably about a half a mile off the road, there's a detention center there for little boys. Some of these boys have gotten involved with crime. Some of them have just been abandoned. And my dad, the last few years that he worked, he was a guard there. And he would come in and he would tell my mother, and he would have tears in his eyes, and he would talk about how that as he would walk those hallways that he could hear those boys crying because they were all alone. Here in the middle of the night, you've got these 10, 12, 14-year-old little boys, and they're just in there, and they're just whimpering and sobbing. They're forsaken by everybody. And Jesus has been forsaken. A few minutes ago, we heard a song, and when they sang this, I thought they're using my message this morning. The Bible tells us in Psalm 37:25, "I've been young," David said, "and I've been old, but I've never seen the righteous forsaken." And if you know Christ, can I tell you that Hebrews tells us that he will never leave you nor forsake you? Just this past week, I've had two different ladies tell me, "Preacher, I want you to pray for me. I say, it seems as though that God is nowhere around when I try to pray. With the things that we've got going on in our family right now, I just don't know how much more I can take." And I've tried to assure both of those ladies that God knows exactly where you're at. I can't tell you always why, except that God has a purpose, God has a plan, and God has the strength to get you through it. And so Jesus, for the first time, has a severed relationship with the Father. No voice from heaven, no voice from a friend. The only thing he's probably hearing, if he's listening at all, because there's something else that's happening, maybe some of the murmuring from those that are milling around here in the darkness at the foot of the cross. The second thing that I want you to see is, why did Jesus have to suffer? Why did Jesus have to suffer? The short answer is because of sin. The justice and the holiness of God demanded that sin had to be paid for. Can I tell you that during that darkness, I believe that there was a divine judgment that was taking place? I want you to not miss that. There was a divine judgment that was taking place. It wasn't a human that was judging him. They had already nailed him to the cross, but the only reason they did that is because he let them. But God himself began judging Jesus during that 3 hours as he hung there in the darkness. I've often heard this statement. Well, God is kind of like your grandpa. You know, I mean, he's just kind of like, you know, an old guy up in heaven, and, you know, and he'll just give you anything you want, and he won't ever spank you, and you know, just kind of, they make God almost as though, you know, he's just there to be tolerated. But can I tell you, that is not a Bible picture of God. God is a just God. God is a holy God. And God will never sacrifice his justice or his holiness on the altar of his love. You need to make sure that you remember that. I thought about this past Wednesday night. Brother James has been teaching in here on the churches of Asia Minor. And he used the phrase called, and I've heard him use it on numerous occasions, he said that God is a thrice holy God. The word thrice is an old English word which means three times. And if you read through the book of Isaiah, you'll find that the seraphim, which are a special order of angels, they have six wings. And with two of those wings, as they fly back and forth in the presence of God, they cover their faces with two of those wings because of the holiness of God. And as they fly with two of the wings, and two more wings cover their feet in humility, and as they fly back and forth, they're saying, "Holy, holy, holy." They know about the holiness of God. Now, there's people, and they say things like this. Well, God is a God of light. In him is no darkness at all. I think that's true to a certain degree, but let me tell you something. When the judgment of God begins to fall, there's darkness. And I believe that the judgment of God fell on the person of Jesus Christ during this 3 hours of darkness. He's hanging there, and God is piling on Jesus all the sins of every person that'll ever be saved. He's saying, I've got Tommy Foskey's sins, and I'm pouring them on Jesus. And I've got, and you can put your name in the blank, sins, and I'm pouring them on Jesus. And that sacrificial Lamb of God is having all of these things heaped upon him. And people have said things like this, well, God turned his back on Jesus. I don't think God turned his back on Jesus. I think that God was punishing Jesus. If you want me to give you a description, I would simply say this: hell came to Calvary. The 3 hours that Jesus hung there, he suffered the same measure of you and I suffering eternity in all of hell. And God put that upon him in 1 3-hour span of time. Can I tell you that I can't comprehend that? I know that Jesus is the Son of God, and I know that he never forfeited his position of the second person of the Trinity. I know that. But at the same time, God the Father began to heap on him the iniquity of us all. That judgment at darkness is seen throughout the Bible. I jotted down a few verses. Isaiah 8:22, and they shall look unto the earth and behold trouble and darkness, dimness of anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness. Nahum 1:8, but with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. Joel 2:31, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. What about Matthew, New Testament? Matthew 22:13, then said the king to the servants, bind him hand and foot, take him away and cast him into outer darkness, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. You can see the judgment of God over and over and over in darkness. What about in the land of Egypt when the death angel came at night? There was judgment of God. And can I tell you that this judgment that Jesus is suffering, he's suffering at the hands of God the Father? Hold your place in our text, and I want you to turn to the Old Testament, and I want you to go to Isaiah 53, and I want to read 4 or 5 verses. Look with me to prove this point. Look with me at verse 4. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken. Listen to this. Smitten of God and afflicted. Look at verse 6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Verse 7. He was oppressed. He was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. He didn't call 10,000 angels. He didn't say, Father, let's call this thing off. No, he is brought as a lamb to the slaughter. And as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Look with me at verse 10. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. In other words, it satisfied God to pummel Jesus. He hath put him to grief when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. Look at verse 11. He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus looked into that cup Somebody says, oh, he didn't really know how bad it was going to be. Oh, yes, he did. He knew exactly how bad it was going to be. And that's why he recoiled from it. And he uttered, Father, if there be another way, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. And so here we have God punishing Jesus in the darkness. I don't believe God turned his back on him. Now, I know that there's a verse in Habakkuk that says, O Lord, thou art too pure to look upon sin. But there's also a verse that says that God is angry with the wicked every day. God knows what they're doing, so he sees it. God doesn't have blinders on. God knows everything that's going on. And this darkness is part of the hell that Jesus suffered so you and I wouldn't have to suffer. Can I tell you, this is a little snapshot of what hell is going to be like for unbelievers? Jesus, when he was talking about hell, he said it's going to be a place of outer and utter darkness. And here during this 3 hours, you've got the Father piling up these transgressions and sin after sin, and they're just pouring over Jesus, the Son of God, as he hangs there, a sacrificial lamb. And all of those pourings contain my sins and yours. And then it's as though Jesus can't take it any longer. And there at the end of that little 3 hour span, and I say little, it will seem like an eternity, I'm sure, to Jesus. Piercing the darkness, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Can I tell you that it was not a whimpering when he talked? He had been nailed to that cross at 9 o'clock. It's now approaching probably 3 o'clock. He has already been beaten and he's lost blood through the scourgings. He's already lost strength helping to carry that cross. Finally, they had to get another man, Simon, to help carry it. They nail him. And he's trying to help other people as he's nailed there. And now, with everything that's been piled upon him, he still has the strength to almost in a loud voice to startle everybody. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Forsaken of God. Now, did God really forsake him? Yeah, I think he did. But can I tell you that it was only temporary? And once that payment was paid, Jesus will utter another saying. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to preach on that. He says, it is finished. But for today, he's forsaken of God. Which brings me to my last question. Will God forsake sinners today? Oh, have you not heard somebody say, oh, God is too loving to have a place called hell? God would never punish somebody in hell. You know, hell is a state of mind. It's really the grave. The only problem with that is it's just not biblical. The Bible tells us in Revelation chapter 20 that God is going to take both the grave, both death and hell, and cast both of them into the lake of fire. And there's a difference between hell and the lake of fire. And if you don't know that, think of this. Think about hell as being a county jail, and think about the lake of fire as being a federal penitentiary. You may go to the temporary place for a while, but if you're found guilty and convicted, they're going to move you to the big house. And so you've got hell, which is a temporary holding place, but ultimately one day there'll be an eternity And in that eternity, there's going to be a lake of fire that burns with fire and brimstone forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And you and I need to understand that, yes, there will come a time when God will forsake sinners. Now, while you're alive, if you don't know Christ, if your friends don't know Christ, if you've got family members that don't know Christ, while they've got breath, they have the opportunity to come to Christ. But can I tell you, when they take their last breath or the Lord comes back, he's going to shut this history down. And once the curtain is down, it's over. You say, oh, I just don't believe God would do anything like that, preacher. Well, let me ask you a question. Did he not cast Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden after they sinned and would not let them back in? Did he not tell Noah, I want you to build a big boat, and I want your wife, and I want your boys and their wives, I want all eight of you to get inside of that boat? And the rains came, and the rains came down, and the floods came up. You remember that little kid song? Well, I'm going to tell you something. That's a cute little song, but all I can imagine over in Genesis is this. People beating on the outside of that boat saying, let us in, let us in. But God's the one that shut that door, not Noah. What about Sodom and Gomorrah? Abraham said, Lord, don't destroy it. My nephew's there. And God said, okay, if you can find 50 righteous men. And Abraham said, what about 40? God said, okay, 40. Abraham said, what about 30? Okay, what about 20? And he got God negotiated all the way down to 10, and they couldn't even find 10 righteous people in all of Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities. And God had Lot basically drug out of the city. And the fires began to fall, and the fire and the hailstone began to rain down upon that place. And today, the only thing that you know of Sodom and Gomorrah is it's probably somewhere under the Dead Sea on one of the shores. There are some people that think that maybe they found some artifacts from it, but nobody knows that for sure. Let me ask you another question. You remember when the nation of Israel, when they divided, King Solomon dies, and all of a sudden, the kingdom splits. Two tribes go south, 10 tribes go north. The 10 tribes were more godless than the ones in the south. And they began to worship idols. And finally, God had the Assyrians come in, and he wiped what is known as Israel out. He did not take care of Judah until later, about 150 years later. But he wiped northern 10 tribes out. And can I ask you a question? Where are those 10 tribes today? You can't have people get identified by that. Those 10 tribes are called the lost tribes of Israel. And so you've got that, and you say, oh, preacher, all of those are Old Testament things. Well, let me ask you a question. In Romans chapter 1, did the Apostle Paul not say three times under the inspiration of the Holy Ghost, I give them up? Did he not say that? He did say that. What about this? What about over in Revelation chapter 3? He's looking at the Laodicean church, and because that church was made up of people that they weren't hot, they weren't cold, and God said, I'll spew you out of my mouth. I would that you were either hot or cold. I'd either you want me to be on fire for me or not have anything to do with me. Don't be lukewarm. Don't be a mamby-pamby Christian. If you're going to be kind of lukewarm, God basically said in the Greek, I'll vomit you out of my mouth. There ought to be some commitment on behalf of God's people. But people that are in the church that don't know Christ, there'll come a time when they're going to be lost forever. And then Jesus, with his own words, they said, there's going to be some people that will come to me and they'll say, Lord, did we not preach in your name? And what is he going to say to them? Depart from me, I never knew you. And so will God forsake sinners today? While there's breath, I don't think so. But can I tell you, there's coming a day when he will? And it doesn't matter how the cries of hell, how they, oh God, come save us, come save us. Can I tell you that in Luke 16, there was a rich man that went to hell and he's still there today? He said, if I could just have Lazarus, who was a beggar, just come with a little water and dip his finger in the water and touch my tongue just to cool it. But he couldn't even have that. And people say, oh, that's just a parable. Can I tell you that parables are usually identified, and that's not identified as a parable? So is there going to come a time? Yes, there is. But can I tell you that today, if you'll come, is not that day for you? The Bible tells us that today is the day of salvation. Don't harden your heart. That's what the scriptures tell us in Corinthians. It tells us also, boast not thyself of tomorrow. I've known of people and they would say, oh, I'm going to wait till I get on my deathbed and then I'm going to get saved. The only problem is you don't know when that's going to happen. And so out of the darkness, he cries. But can I tell you that even though he felt as though God had forsaken him, do you notice what he still called him? He said, my God. In other words, I'm still claiming him as my God. Some of you have had troubles, and it seems like that every year of your life, the troubles grow. And sometimes you think that it can't get any worse, and then it does. And you're like these two ladies that I talked to last week, and they go, I don't know how much more I can take. I'm at the end of my rope. Can I tell you that he's still your God? He is still your God, and just because you feel forsaken, you're not. David said, I was young, and now I'm old. But I've never seen the righteous forsaken or God's seed begging bread. God may have forsook Jesus for a short time, but he did it for you and he did it for me. Oh, folks, when I think about the fact that Jesus did that for me, it makes me want to serve him every day of my life. And I hope that you have that same burning in your soul that I just want to live for God because of what Jesus has done for me. Let's stand together.